It's a big night. It's apparently an election night. More importantly, I got 280 characters on Twitter. Powered by Red Wine, this is the Punk News Podcast, episode 376. I feel like I had more things in my head for that intro than I did, but whatever. Hi, I'm Adam White. You're listening to the Punk News Podcast. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the show tonight, out of Nowheresville, America, Mr. John Gentile on the run from the law.
You know, everyone's excited they got 288 things on Twitter, but Twitter knocked me down to 40.
it's like a merit-based system.
Yeah. They said your Twitter's so shitty, we're only going to give you 40 characters a tweet.
You know, they actually
got to pay.
They actually haven't distributed this evenly because they went and they said, "Oh, we're going to give 280 to most of the world, but to like, I think it was like Japan and Korea or like places that have an alphabet where you can express more in fewer characters." They've given them less, like they've left them at 140, I think, because they just like, oh, they don't need it. Like the average Japanese tweet or something is like 15 characters, so they don't need 280. So someone like sitting around in San Francisco at the Twitter headquarters, like determined arbitrarily that like these whole swaths of humanity, based on our understanding of how they use their language, they don't need this, so they don't get it. Which is weird. That is weird to me.
Well, you know, the Japanese are known for their efficiency. What's that word they use for in the supply chain management? They're like famous. Like the Japanese are famous for their supply chain management, which I know is very interesting to the Punk News Podcast listeners. Let me look it up.
Are you thinking Kanban?
While you guys talk.
That's the thing.
Is it called Kanban? It's like a philosophy or something.
Yeah, this is important. Oh, it's like Shizen something or other. Oh, no, wait, that's German. Also, joining me from Nowheresville, America.
No, Nowheresville, America.
You don't care if people find you, right? Like, if they find you, you'll...
No, not at all. Matter of fact, I might tell a story. I told a story last week about a famous rock star who grew up in the small town that I currently live in, and I might tell another anecdote.
Yeah, like, if anyone wants to find Tom Trauma...
This week. To be an election. Yeah, like, election
you'll either election befriend them, or... Yeah, like or
shoot them in the face because you know I live in the Midwest.
Like, really, like you have nothing to fear. No, like I feel like kind of like the giant at the top of the beanstalk, right?
But fear itself. Like,
you're pretty much impervious.
I don't know about that. It's I live in a pretty quiet little place.
John, have you figured out whatever?
But yeah, I'm not. I have no whatever have no
important
fears.
Japanese industrial term is.
It's not like feng shui or something like that, is it, John?
That's Kaizen. Kaizen.
Oh yeah,
that was close.
Really doesn't ring a bell at all.
You said Kanban.
Yeah,
what's Kanban?
Really? Well, like
that sounds Australian
Kanban. This is the most punk rock thing ever. Is something that they used at Toyota when doing project planning to like decide like who's working on a task and if that task is in progress. And it's like a really simple sort of chart where you move different parts of the. Of the job from kind of one board to the other. Hi, this is the Punk News Podcast. We're talking about Japanese industrial processes. Anyways, so yeah, so that's the thing. So yeah, so Twitter has granted me the power, John. They have arbitrarily decided that the Japanese and a bunch of other people from that end of the world don't. I mean, when I was at, I was at a music festival in Quebec called FME over the, over the Labor Day weekend. And there was a journalist that I was talking with there that was from France that had come in to cover it for like some French rock radio station. And for some reason we were sitting in the bar and we got to talking about Twitter and things like that. And he mentioned to me that like in France, they hate it because you can't express a full thought in proper written French within 140 characters. And you end up always having to make some sort of dumb compromise, like you use multiple tweets or you have to like cut words out. And actually, we were talking about this, come to think of it, because there were a number of French bands that were there, and a lot of the bands that were French speaking bands would sing in English. And I was just sort of I was asking like why is that? Like why are we not hearing more of these like French rock bands come and sing exclusively in French? And he's like, well, I'm like, is it just an influence thing? Like they grew up listening to, you know, Green Day and the Clash and things like that, and when they started writing their own music, like they're writing in English, or was there some other aspect to it? And Hugh said, like, that's a part of it, is that like culturally a lot of that rock and roll is in English, he said, but the biggest part of it is that like when you look at the way that like a rock song is written from like a poetry standpoint, like, you know, how many words are on a line and how much you can express in a typical verse of a 4/4 rock song and all that kind of stuff. He's like, English is far more expressive given those constraints. And if you try to meet that same rhythm by and singing in like proper French, you can't. So you either express less or you end up having to like cut words out, and cutting words out and chopping up French just does not work as well as it does in English. Like English is a really fucked up language, but it's pretty malleable, and you can still express a thought by like lopping whole words out of a sentence and really fucking up the grammar and everything. And you can, especially in the context of a rock song, it all works. In French, though, it sounds really awkward and weird. And that's what got us talking about Twitter. And he's like, the same thing. He's like, if you want to actually effectively use Twitter as a French person, it's super frustrating because you can't say anything, because, you know, everything takes more words and more characters to say. So that, you know, they're probably happy with their 280.
Biggest vocabulary in the world, baby. Biggest vocabulary in the world. Oh yeah.
Are you shilling for English right now?
I'm repping English, baby. It's a wonderful language. People love
weird to, number pe- one.
People love weird to diss on English. They're like, oh, well, English has so many irregular verbs. Yeah, because it's an awesome, complex language that is able to express nuanced thoughts, concepts, and inflections. Whereas other languages, I ain't going to be dissing other languages, but you know which languages I'm talking about. You all know.
Yeah, Spanish. Fuck you. Yeah.
Spanish is a great language, but Spanish does have a much more limited vocabulary than English.
Yeah, because they have rules. And it's not just this complete, like,
well, English is a very interesting language. It's a hybrid between Germanic and Latin, and so that's why it's got all these weird bizarre rules, and of course it has words from a whole bunch of other languages in it too. So
anyways, yeah, that's my weird vocabulary, baby. See, I was able to tie my dumb conversation about Twitter character limits into a legitimate conversation about rock and roll that I had with someone, so there, that fits, that's on the podcast, that works.
And quite ironically, the Ramones, who are often considered the greatest punk rock band ever, really only use like 7 words in a song.
Yeah, most of them were don't.
And 3 chords.
Anywho, what are we doing on tonight's show, John? Do we have any mail before we get into into the stuff?
We got some good mail. Do you guys want to hear a regular first or a first timer first?
First timer, because I feel like the regular... The last episode, I yelled at one of them.
It's going to be Liverpool yeah. Neil yelling about something.
This is from first timer Will. Will says, I first got into Oingo Boingo when I was 12, probably because Danny Elfman is funny. I like all of the Oingo Boingo albums, even the ill-fated Boingo album. I was surprised as anyone when Danny Elfman wrote the score to Nightmare Before Christmas and sang the songs. People may make fun of the movie these days, but Nightmare Before Christmas is an excellent movie made before Tim Burton became a parody of himself. Danny Elfman has, I'm not sure what he's trying to say, Danny Elfman has held up well, is what he's saying. I think people hate Nightmare because stores like Hot Topic slap the movie's characters on everything and pseudo-goth kids adopted it into the mainstream, making it a joke. But the movie still holds up. Have you had anything that you love get co-opted, resulting in it getting shit upon when really it is very good? From Will.
Punk rock, mainly.
the Misfits.
Oh, that's
you know, like what Jerry Only did to the Misfits, like putting them on coffee mugs and socks, and because I mean the original Misfits albums were just like some of the greatest punk.
It's actually a really good question. I kind of want to think about that for a second.
Nightmare Before Christmas is a great movie. It really is. I know like a bunch of like emo kids and stuff like have them on their backpacks and stuff, but it's a great movie.
I'm never sure if I should have disdain for when a piece of culture gets pulled into this like high school goth slash emo universe. And I don't know why, like, but part of me wants to be like, fuck those guys. But I don't know why, like, I probably have a lot in common with them and I don't actually bear them any particular ill will, but there is some reflexive, like, fashion based judgment that's in my head where I hold them suspicious. But yeah. Okay. So let's see here. What's been co-opted and is co-opted to the point of being annoying? I feel okay. I mean, this is going to be a little bit in general, but so I grew up in the
streets.
Yeah. I grew up in the 90s and I grew up as like an awkward, weird 90s kid that was, you know, a nerd. And so much of the stuff that I engaged with as my entertainment before I really got into music, right? So comic books, like Star Trek, Star Wars, all that kind of stuff, right? Like all this stuff that I was into is now, and I was into secretly, like I wouldn't, like I wasn't hiding it, but like I wouldn't, you know, walk into my grade 9 class and start talking about, you know, Next Gen to anyone, right? Like that's not the way that worked. But
wait, was that a Malibu comic, Next Gen?
Yeah.
No, that's Gen 13. Do you remember Gen 13?
Gen 13 was an Image comic. I'm talking about Star Trek, The Next Generation. Fuck, John.
Oh, Next Generation. Yes. I think there's an X-Men called Next Gen too.
Maybe. Dude, in any case, right?
Star Trek Next Generation rules. So, listen, I'll talk about that to anybody.
Yeah, okay, but like grade 9 Adam that was like desperately trying to like not be a complete dork probably didn't. But in any case, like all that stuff that I was into at the time,
interesting that you call it Next Gen, Adam. I call it TNG.
Yeah, that's not interesting. But no, so all that stuff is now mainstream, right? Like it's all completely mainstream, and this like nerd culture thing because of the internet has taken over the world. And you know they're gonna make a movie about Thor of all fucking things, and it's gonna make a bazillion dollars. And everyone's out there celebrating this geek culture thing as being the new pop culture, and I hate it, John. Like I fucking hate it. And it's not that I hate the actual cultural outputs. Like I'll go watch Marvel movies all day long. I'm like, I'm cool with all that. It's more that like I hate this celebration of it where something that was like entertainment for like weird kids and you know, and misfits and people that weren't into, like, I don't know what other kids in my age were into, like fucking like NFL football or something and the Spice Girls or whatever else. Right. But all this stuff is now completely mainstream and obnoxiously mainstream. And I noticed it when we've hired people that are like younger than me, but like totally seeped in that culture. I will kindly, I'm going to give them a name, John, that I'm just going to make one up. I'm going to call them millennials, right? So we've had people that work for us that they would like schlump into the office and they are just like, they're draped in all of this geek culture ephemera, right? Like they're wearing like a fucking Spider-Man shirt and they're, you know, we had this one kid that every time he got a text message in the office, his text message noise was the noise from The Legend of Zelda that it would make when you got like a little coin or a little jewel or whatever it is in Legend of Zelda, right?
You know, honestly, I'm surprised that the kid didn't, or whoever, like, didn't turn off the noise for the text messages in the office. I'm surprised that.
Yeah, that was part of his reasons for dismissal, is that he was annoying and not absolutely un. what's the word I'm trying to look for? He didn't realize that other people existed that weren't in his bubble. But in any case, right?
Like everybody texts it.
I just love that Adam, the ninth grade like comic nerd, was like the one who wanted to put him in the locker.
It's just that, like, it's like, but life like, has come it's, full it's circle. It's this thing for where him. It's like, there's no shame anymore, right? Everyone's just like, hey, whatever, we're into this dumb bullshit, and we are going to be into it obnoxiously and loudly and all the time. And I'm like, no, like when I was reading fucking like Alpha Flight comics and, you know, and watching Deep Space Nine and stuff like that, like that was stuff that I did on my own and did not throw it in people's faces. And if I did talk about it with people, it was with weirdos on the internet and some message board somewhere under an assumed name. It wasn't something that I was going to like waltz into an employer with like a fucking Wolverine shirt on and start making Super Mario noises all over the place. Like the fact that all of this stuff that was like the pop culture, the culture of my childhood, right, it is now just loudly farting at everyone all the time. It kind of makes me sad, and I'm gonna use that as my example. Like the geek culture thing is gross.
I'll
children,
say that
fuck you.
I'm not down with the babyization of adults. You know what I mean? Like, listen, I love Star Trek Next Generation. I like X-Men. I'm a huge Star Wars guy. But I'm a grown man. I don't need to be wearing, like, Star Wars pajamas and shit. You know what I mean? And I don't need to be like, oh, wow, did you see Luke Skywalker? You know, it's cool. It's cool. But, I mean, it's not the most important thing in my life. You know what I mean?
Did I derail this? Was this the question?
I don't know. Listen, the point...
Now you got me feeling defensive, John, because like, you know, I'm in my 40s and, you know, I have like a kid who just started college and I have kids in high school. And like, if I show up for a parent teacher conference, I'm, you know, likely to be wearing a TSOL t-shirt.
You mean the band? I'm that
all the time. I'm not a character, John. I am me.
Listen, Tom, you know? You don't know the rule. It's cool to wear band shirts. It's dorky to wear comic book shirts, even though I like comic books. Listen.
Well, I remember asking my kids one time, like, does it bother you that like your friend's parents are wearing like ties and cardigans and things? And, you know, and I'm wearing a, you know, and I have a patch on my jacket and I'm wearing band t-shirts.
I think there's the thing, like you're repping a subculture and.
Yeah. But once again, it's not as dangerous or as deep a subculture as it used to be either. Much like the comic book thing. You know what I mean? There's no danger. And I don't know that there ever really was in my life, you know, in my getting into it in the late
80s. But on the other, like, you can't buy a TSOL shirt at Target or Kmart, but you can totally buy like a Star Wars shirt at Kmart, you know? I guess the issue with that kind of thing is it's so main, it doesn't express anything. If anything, it expresses a herd mentality where it used to express a sort of individuality. Yeah, that's it, I think. You know, like if you were in the Star Wars, you used to be like, like, this is the unique thing that I'm into, that a group of people that I know are into. But now it's like, oh, I have to like Star Wars. I have to like Marvel because everybody does.
But Star Wars, man, Star Wars came out when I was like 5 or 6 years
old. People forget,
man. I was 4. It came out in 77. But that's what I'm saying. But it was such a phenomenon. It wasn't any kind of a subculture when I was a kid. It was mainstream, dude. I mean, it was
possibly true.
Everybody was into it.
But from about 1986 through 1994, I believe it was, that was, I guess, the nadir of Star Wars popularity, and it kind of was a subculture only when they
really, you think the nadir was after?
Yeah, oh, I mean, not content wise, yeah. but when they re-released the movie on VHS in 1997, that's when it jumped back up and became a mainstream thing.
You see, I remember when I was during that period, your nadir there, I was up north in Ontario at like a family, like some extended family's cottage that they had on a lake up there, and there were kids that were. Whoever owned the cottage was the kids were older than me by, I don't know, let's say like 5 years, but that's probably even stretching it. But like they were older than I was, right? And they had like in the bunks in this cabin, like some Star Wars, like the first Star Wars movie, like A New Hope, like some Star Wars picture book thing that was just like big photos from the movie that basically like followed the whole plot. And I never seen this before, and I never encountered it like in the media or in or like, you know, it wasn't something that like in like 1993, like kids who were like 13 weren't like talking about Star Wars or anything, right? Like, so I was younger than that even, but it doesn't matter. Like I had to like find some fucking book in a cabin in the woods and go through it and go like, oh, what is this? Like, yeah, like there's the robots in this. This is fun, right?
Well, you know, I had all that stuff, Adam. You know, my childhood, if I would have saved it, would have been a wonderland for your preteenness. But my mother, unfortunately, was not much one for sentimental holding on.
So, all right, you nerds. Is this the end of the story? Because
I don't know. I mean, to round back to this, like,
you know, there wasn't really
this does kind of cycle back into the whole punk rock thing, because I'm sure everyone felt this when, like, you know, when Green Day and the Offspring all of a sudden blew up again and in 95 and all that, right? Is it like that there are things that you can be into and then all of a sudden everyone is into or but I think more than that, like everyone is into in a way that you find obnoxious, and it's super strange and grating because you have to sort of contend, you have to sort of weigh your fanship or your enjoyment of it against the fact that if you're anything like me, humble listener, you don't really want to be into the thing that everyone in the world is into.
And you all should aspire.
It's difficult. And you don't want to be a dick about it. Like you don't want to be the guy out there slashing, you know, against me's tires because they signed to a moderately bigger label, but at the same point, you sort of hate everyone, so it's a difficult thing to navigate.
Well,
there's just no way to say I was into this band before they got big without sounding like a douche. It's just not.
That's why I get into bands and tell everyone they should listen to them, and then no one cares about the band ever. And that's why, listen, I hate every.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think you create an open hostility for any band you champion. As far as I can.
What's our second letter here? Let's do it.
This is from Liverpool Neil. Here's what Liverpool Neil says.
Oh. I called it.
I've been listening to episode 373. Here are some assorted thoughts. I love it when Tom Trauma is on the show. You need his deadpan humor and older cynicism to balance out the younger voices and opinions of Ricky and staffer Sean. Number two.
I thought you were going to say you 30-year-old, 35-year-old whippersnappers. Yeah, right.
Number two. I swear that when Adam isn't talking, he isn't even listening to the rest of the show. Number three.
I've suspected that for years.
I totally agree with you all on the lackluster Record Store Day Black Friday releases. Holy crap, this is terrible. And suggests to me that the folks behind Record Store Day have completely run out of steam. If we are expecting people to get excited about Neil Young reissues, then Record Store Day just needs to stop, or at least go back to once per year. It should have some unusual stuff and stuff that we cannot normally get easily, or new stuff. And that brings me to my main point. Now on to something that should be remastered and released for Record Store Day, and I can't even believe it hasn't happened yet. Everything else in the Clash's back catalog has been reissued, remastered, repackaged, put on colored vinyl, etc., etc., etc. Even Joe Strummer and the Mescalero stuff has been reissued. So why the hell hasn't someone taken the original tapes of Cut the Crap and remastered the hell out of it? Take out all the stupid electronic shit and all the wacky noises and backing tracks and leave us with the album that it could have been. You will actually find some great songs buried deep in the nonsense if you listen hard enough. So why hasn't this happened yet? That just seems crazy to me. Do you guys agree? That is the kind of thing that should happen to Record Store Day. Okay, love the show. Do me a favor and play. Do me a favor and play the new Penetration cover of Shake Some Action. It's really good. Stay free from Liverpool Neil. I'll point out that Liverpool Neil has a great idea. You know, they'll often like now it's kind of cool to release alternate editions of albums. Like they just released an alternate edition of David Bowie's Young Americans, and I always find that like really boring. Like when with the Led Zeppelin reissues, they reissued like alternate edition of every album with the deluxe album, and it's like I don't want to hear that. I want to hear the classic album, your alternate version that you made after the fact. Like isn't going to be as good. It's just going to be annoying. But what if when they do the alternate albums, they actually took shitty albums and tried to make them good?
I guess I should probably go back and listen to the specific albums that Cut the Crap. I do have it, but man, I can't say I've listened to it in years. And I think there was like a couple of songs on it that I enjoyed. I don't know that you can do enough to save that
album. It's a tough listen, man. It's just like boring, you know?
It's so uninspired. Yeah. And I'll defend Combat Rock all day. I thought that was really, really solid. But, I don't know. I don't know, Neil. Maybe I'll try to give it a spin.
I think it'd be a neat project for somebody to go behind it, like, you know, just take it apart. Kind of like the last Joe Strummer album was made in part after he passed away. So it would be cool if they just took
screwed and chopped.
It would be cool if they screwed and chopped, cut the crap. Adam, why, any words on cut the crap, or should we cut this crap and get moving along?
I would actually really like to hear a. I mean, there are bootlegs from that record, are there not, that strip out some of the.
Yeah, maybe if you put the guitar up front a little more and got rid of some of the. Yeah,
that's one that you could even do as like an officially sanctioned project, because it's not like anyone in the Clash universe is owning Cut the Crap anyways, right? Like they're all pretending it doesn't exist. So you may as well just fuck it up and see what you can do with it.
I would have Joel Grind do it. He's like the metal guy that.
Well, like do awesome. You remember there was a Clash documentary that came out a few years ago, probably like 10 years ago, called West Way to the World. And I remember going through the DVD extras on the West Way to the World DVD. And in one of the extras is like this discography thing that you can like walk through the discography, and it just stops before Cut the Crap. Like, there is no acknowledgement that album even exists. it's amazing, like, the revisionist like Clash history there, where we've just decided that like Cut the Crap does not even exist, right? And I've always treated it that way. Like, I've never thought, like, there's difficult albums by bands I love that I've been like, okay, I gotta figure out what's up with this record, right? But I've even treated Cut the Crap that way, and I'm like, you know, I've probably listened to it like two or three times ever, and I'm like, they don't think it exists, I don't think it exists, if we all collectively don't think it exists, it doesn't exist, right? So there was that.
That is great.
I mean, the other thing, what I thought he was going to say, what I thought Neil was going to say, as far as like a cool reissue, is that I thought he was going to say Cost of Living. And I'd love a vinyl copy of Cost of Living. That EP had like just so much cool stuff that ended up just getting like regurgitated endlessly on the black market versions. But I'm just. As like a package, and like the art is cool. Like, I think the Cost of Living EP is a cool little thing. It's been one of those things that you cannot purchase at a normal store in North America, but in England there's used copies of it everywhere. So I had it on a Discogs want list at some point, and it just meant I got like four emails a day that was like 900 people are selling Cost of Living. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to actually buy that from England though. Thank you. Stop. Now, before we move on, John,
Adam,
can we play the Penetration cover of Shake Some Action? Because I mean,
sure.
I mean, I want to do what our listeners want, unless it's murder. But on the other, but even more so than that,
like, I would consider murder for the right listener and the right victim.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. But,
I mean, listen, Neil's a regular. He's
got a lot of murder credit kind of built up. Yeah, exactly. Like, if you write us enough letters, eventually you get like what's like a point every 10 letters, and you get 6 points. Tom will kill someone. Like,
after a while, listeners, you won't even have to write letters. You can just think it, and we'll automatically.
So it's like high C points. Like, the more you listen to the punk, like, first you get like a fanny pack, and then you get like a jug. You know, first you get murder.
You got to cut the little cardboard thing out of the corner of the package.
Yeah. All right. So let's do this. So Shake Some Action, 1976 track by the Flamin' Groovies. It's such a cool fucking song. I have not heard the Penetration version of it. So. Better be awesome. Penetration, veteran UK punk band formed 1976. Not talked about a whole hell of a lot. They ran from like 1976 until 1980, got back together in 2001. So here you go. This is a cover of the Flamin' Groovies classic, like the seminal Flamin' Groovies track, Shake Some Action, by veteran UK punk band Penetration for Mr. Liverpool Neil. All right, we're back. We're talking about veterans. So let's talk about one that probably didn't consent to something. There is a high-end fashion retailer, John. I don't know if you heard of this one. They're called Barney's.
I buy everything at Barney's.
Oh, okay. So here's something.
That's the purple dinosaur guy, right?
They're also a... I was about to like say some fact about Barney's, but I don't really know anything about Barney's.
No, they're like a high end. I know. They're a mall.
They're a store. Anyways, Barney's New York.
Did they sell TSOL t-shirts?
Well, what they're selling, Mr. Tom Trauma, is a punk jacket with some hand painted designs on it for a mere $1,085 US dollars, mind you. So this jacket appears to, and this is the interesting part here, it either has a Sham 69 patch or it has the Sham 69 logo painted on the jacket itself. It is described by the retailer as, and this sentence makes absolutely no grammatical sense to me, so I apologize if I stumble over it. It is described as constructed of black cotton blend canvas, resurrect by Night X Alpha Industries XO Barney's New York's M65 field jacket is finished with paint splatter details, a skull, and leave the past behind lettering at the back, and rebel lettering on the sleeve. First issued by the U.S. Army Services in 1965, this classic Alpha Industries silhouette is customized with signature hand-painted graphics by Bronx-born artist and Resurrect by Night founder Darren Chambers. So it's an old U.S. Army jacket that they've painted, is I guess the long and short of that. So now this, how did this show up in your universe, John? Because you went and you noticed, or at least someone told you here that this was a jacket that had the Sham 69 logo on it here.
Actually, I'm pretty proud of myself. Is if you look later on down in the article, they're selling like a $375 jacket that just has like random shit like scribbled on it. And John Joseph was basically saying, if you think this is punk, then you're an idiot or something like that. And then I was clicking around Barney because I remembered a couple of years ago, Barney's was selling like a $275 Black Flag shirt. And then I saw.
Was that Barney's?
Yeah,
too?
Yeah. And then I saw this $1,000 punk jacket and I clicked on it. And lo and behold, I saw the Sham 69 logo.
So we broke this news. Holy cow.
We did break this news.
We're going to assume that Sham 69. I mean, if Sham 69 is involved in this, I hope they're getting like a little cut of that 1,085.
I don't think I doubt it. I mean,
I have a couple. Let's see. Let's go ahead, Adam.
I don't know. That's all I got. So we're assuming that this is not an officially sanctioned Sham 69 thing. This would. I mean, if you want to ascribe blame to someone or find out if they. If they are the one that that did this Mr. Chambers, who has put together this collection for Barney's, would presumably be the person to talk to. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think, Tom?
Well, a couple things. The M65 is a classic jacket, and a young, impressionable Tom Trauma had one as a teenager, actually, because in the 80s, there was still so much, like, Vietnam surplus stuff around. So, like, all the boots we wore were the, I don't remember what they were called anymore, but they had, like, they were partially canvas and partially leather. So I was a huge fan of Vietnam surplus clothes when I was younger. So that's a great jacket, sits below the waist. For a kid growing up in the Midwest like myself, it was wonderful to keep me warm in the winters. I did not write anything on it or put any patches on. It was much later that I started putting patches all over everything. But anyway, it's a great jacket. And here's the thing with Sham 69 that I find it ironic that they're the ones that are on there. Great, great iconic band. You know, kind of second, you know, wave UK band. A lot of great songs. A lot of, like, you know, influenced all the Oi stuff that would follow and all that, blah, blah, blah. But they're sort of become the modern day punk rock REO Speedwagon in that there are two distinct versions of Sham 69 that play. And one of them, the one that tours the US regularly, is the Tim V version, which has, I think, the original Sham 69 bass player and a bunch of other dudes. And then, like, the real one is, I don't think, Lee's England much. And they're, like, they look super, super beat up. I think the very inauthentic version actually puts on a much better show, from my understanding. Don't sue me. I'm not sure. That's just what I've heard. But anyway, it's just funny that it would be Sham 69. I don't know if they're, like, their copyright stuff is in such shambles that they're easy to steal from or what. Because you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't see a Sex Pistols patch on there without somebody getting paid.
I don't understand this whole universe. I'm looking at the what is this? This Resurrect by Night, which is the name of this fashion line. I'm looking at their the Instagram page for them, and it's all this, you know, it's all these, like, punk looking, like, stereotypical punk looking clothes, or it's a lot of, like, black clothing that someone has written on with white out, right? And I can't figure out who'd be buying this stuff, because, you know, the typical person that I would expect that would wear clothes that look like this would not be paying $1,000 for anything, let alone a jacket. So,
but is it like a convoluted 80s movie plot, Adam, where the rich kid, to disappoint his parents, wears these, like, rebellious clothes, like a jacket that literally says rebel on the sleeve?
Honestly, I think what this might be, I think this might be a year late, because if you guys remember, for a hot minute, Kim Kardashian was wearing this guy's jackets. Chris Brown was wearing this guy. There's that famous picture, like, Chris Brown in a Cro-Mags and a DRI jacket or something, and, like, he clearly doesn't even know what it is. So somewhere along the point, some fashion, not designer, a person that dresses rich people. What do you call that guy? The person that...
I don't know. I'm not rich, and I dress myself.
The guy that dresses rich people, he said, well...
What do you... I don't know. Is that a person? Is that a thing?
Yeah. Stylist. Some stylist, yes. Said, here's what's going to be cool this year. And then, you know, cool people started wearing that. Like, even... Like, this guy's jackets are terrible and cheesy. I mean, they look like amateur, you know, jackets. Kind of the same thing with the Affliction. You know what I mean? So anyways...
These stories, honestly, are so prevalent lately. I swear, this is, like, our third most common topic after punk rock sexual assault and that old rock and roller death. This is, like, our third most common story lately.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, I mean, if you are a rich person and you want to buy, like, a $100 jacket that's been painted, hand-painted to have punk iconography on it, like, all the power to you. I just hope Sham 69 made their dollar off this, because I doubt that they did.
Well,
I doubt.
Well, two quick things, and then we can change topics. Is could I just make it? I mean, I could make this jacket. You know, I mean, this jacket is not hard to make. If I made this jacket and just said it's $1,000, would somebody buy it? Or, like, is this Resurrect by Night guy, like, some cool guy for some reason, so people buy from him even though his stuff is shitty? You know what I mean? Listen, he's a rich guy wearing a Misfits thing from Resurrect by Night. You know what I mean? And actually, the bootleg Misfits thing too. And Danzig will too. We should email Danzig about this, and he'll email me back and be like, "Good job, John. I knew I could count on you." But
I'll finally give you that interview.
I know, exactly. The point with the Champ 69 thing is it raises an interesting legal question. If it, from the picture, we can't tell if it's a painted on or if it's a patch. It looks to me like it's a patch, but maybe it's painted on.
All the rest of this guy's stuff is painted, so let's assume painted.
Well, that's great for Champ 69 because that is without question trademark and copyright infringement. With copyright, there's what's called the first sale doctrine. If you buy a physical copy of something, you can do with that pretty much whatever you want of that one copy. So let's say you buy a movie script and cut it up and make a poster out of it. You can do that. They can't stop you. But let's say you buy a movie script and photocopy it and make a poster out of that photocopy. That's copyright infringement. So if he painted it on, that's copyright infringement without question. If he bought the patch, it wouldn't be copyright infringement, but it might be trademark infringement because it's sort of suggesting that Champ 69 is authorizing this jacket. But on the other hand, if it's trademark infringement to put someone's patch on the jacket, isn't it implied that with the patch you can put that on whatever jacket you want? There doesn't seem to be a limitation on the license to use the patch. So it probably would not be trademark infringement if he bought the patch, and it certainly would not be copyright infringement if he bought the patch. But if he painted it on, it's both trademark and copyright infringement, and I'd love for Champ 69 to sue over this.
This is exactly the same conversation we had about Against Me and Against Me patch a while back.
Yeah,
I remember this. I remember this conversation.
Well, what if you bought a $1,000 jacket from Barney's that is unadorned? Maybe it's got some whiteout on it. Sure. Okay. And then they give you a Ziploc baggie, and in that Ziploc baggie, there's like 15 safety pins, like some thread and a needle, and then a Sham 69 patch that. that someone himself. Bought from like a head shop or whoever sells patches, right?
They're in the clear. They're in the clear.
Ah. So, John, we got to sell the baggies. And we get in on that whole fucking supply chain. And then we're making bags.
It's like,
I tell you, I have so many patches laying around here. I'm off to a great start. I'm a patch whore. I buy them all the time.
It's like Breaking Bad.
I have more patches than I do fabric to put them on.
It's like Breaking Bad, except for Adam White and I are buying sandwich baggies.
Yeah, we're just reselling sandwich baggies. So, like, we're not going to get sued by Sham 69. We're going to get sued by, like, the Glad Corporation or Procter & Gamble or whoever owns them. That's what we're going to get. Unilever or something. Whoever has the money. Speaking of Against Me, the band, while they were at Fest this year, did a couple special performances, and they billed their performance as playing Reinventing Axl Rose, their first major full length, in its entirety. So there is a video that exists of basically their entire set that you can go check out. There's actually a ton of videos from Fest of full sets. A lot of them are by this one guy videographer named Mike Plant. I don't know. There's an E at the end of his name. I always want to like up the accent on that. But in any case, Mike Plant, that's your name now, shot all this stuff. So thank you. Thank you, Mike. So this performance is not just that. It's actually all of the band's early stuff. So they perform the acoustic EP. They then they perform the acoustic EP just acoustic as a three piece with Laura on acoustic guitar. And then they hop into the full Reinventing Axl Rose record. And then they play the three song Disco Before the Breakdown, which was the EP that they released after that. So they do all of this. They're playing at, where are they? They're at the Woolly venue in Gainesville. And it's not the current Against Me lineup either. They're playing with original bassist Dustin Fridkin joining them for these songs. And there's a special guest because Disco Before the Breakdown has a saxophone on it. That saxophone was played by Jessica Mills, who was at one point in Less Than Jake. And so she comes out and she plays the horns for that part of it. So it's... If you were into early Against Me stuff, this is pretty special. From like a, I don't know what exactly Mike recorded this on, but it's certainly listenable. Like it sounds pretty decent. So, this is there. So if you are an Against Me fan, and chances are if you're listening to this show, you are, you can go check this out. It's kind of neat. Any thoughts on this? I have thoughts on this, but what do you guys think?
It sounds really cool. Unfortunately, I did not watch it. I should have. I didn't. I saw it was really long, and I didn't want to jump into it, but I will have to check that out. I think that would be cool.
Mr. John, any thoughts? Was this an era in which you cared about Against Me, or were you?
I never really cared about Against Me except for Transgender Dysphoria Blues, which I think is a great record. I will say what's interesting about this is, you know, people could say it's interesting how the stand for punk is so malleable in that it's like, oh, you know, the band's getting together to do their original album. They're totally sellouts. Or, oh boy, the band's getting together to do their original album. It's going to be a special thing. Because it's not like Against Me wasn't getting paid for this. Against Me got paid to do this. But I guess because it was at, you know, Fest, which is considered sort of the roots of Against Me or some of the early roots of Against Me, people felt it was organic and natural and a fitting thing to do. And I agree. I think it was cool that Against Me did this, and I mean, if I was, I'm not a fan, but if I was a fan, I think this would be a really neat thing to see.
Yeah, I was watching this on and off as I was getting ready for the show tonight, and it's funny how some of these songs have implanted themselves in my head over the years, where like as soon as they hopped into Pints of Guinness, like I stopped what I was doing and zoned in on this YouTube video and sort of ignored everything else that was going on. And I was emotionally waiting for beats of that song so I could see the crowd react to them. And it was weird how much it affected me. And this is a song I've heard a billion times. I've seen played live so many times, but there was something just about, you know, all of a sudden that song comes on in here and I'm just like, I've lost focus on anything else that was happening in the room. And it was strange to me that happened. But yeah, there was a time where a lot of these songs are really important to me. I was a big fan of the Disco Before the Breakdown EP, I said it earlier. It was a 3-song EP, like a 7-inch that came out between Axl Rose and when the band signed to Fat. And there's a song in there called Tonight We're Going to Give It 35%, which is one of my favorite Against Me songs. And I love the horns on it. And the only thing about this that was kind of disappointing is that there's either the mic was not feeding back through the monitors right or something, but there's some of Jessica's horn playing in this video is inaudible. You can't hear it. And I think it might just be the person that was recording this was like right up at the side of the stage. So I think it was just one of these like that mic wasn't coming back to the stage monitors or something like that. But, you know, oh well, small complaint. But this is cool. You should go check it out. I have not.
It's ruined. The whole thing is ruined. Yeah. It's terrible.
That saxophone is really going to hold the whole thing together. There are tons of these that we have run over the past several days. And there was a performance of by like Adam and His Package. There was a full Hot Water Music set. There was a Flatliner set. And there's actually a ton more that are on Mike Plant's YouTube page. So if you want to go head over to YouTube and check that out. I'm looking at it right now. He uploaded one 2 hours ago. So he's just a machine. He's just putting this shit up there. So if you want to see some live stuff from Fast and you didn't have a chance to get down there, that's what you should do. All right. What do we got? Let's move on. Hey, here we go. Sorry, I was missing my own notes on this. Pretty big news, at least as far as bigger news than I've seen about a punk band doing anything in a while from the standpoint of seeing the rest of the world react to it. Bikini Kill got back together for the first time since 1997 and played a song. So on Saturday, there was an event that was being hosted by writer Jen Pelly. She was hosting a 3-night event celebrating the Raincoats, the band The Raincoats, and a recently released 33 and a third book that she wrote about The Raincoats. And near the end of this, the members of Bikini Kill got up on stage and they performed a song. So Toby Vail, Kathy Wilcox, and Kathleen Hanna got up and they performed for Tammy Ray, which is a song off of their first record.
Pussy Whipped. Pussy Whipped,
Pussy
Whipped.
Pussy Whipped. So they played for Tammy Ray, which is kind of like a slow love songy song off of of A Pussy Whipped, and you can get like a completely unsatisfyingly short video clip of this on Instagram. But pretty big news that I saw resonate all over the place, like places that don't normally talk about stuff like this were chiming in to say like, holy fuck, like Bikini Kill played a song. So I don't know. There's probably not a whole lot that we can say about that, like band played song, but it's neat that happened, I guess. Notable that happened. It is noted. Anything to add, John, or are we know
just same paradigm as the Against Me is this one. Like, there is the rule that if you do something for money, it's suspect, but if you do something not for money, then it's innocent and fun. I don't know if I agree with that, but you know, this was clearly Adam White has talked about this concept before. Is if, say, the Dead Kennedys were going to reunite, it should just be like a surprise where they get on stage at some show and all of a sudden it's the original Dead Kennedy, something like that. So that's the way to do it if you don't have to worry about money, I guess.
I think it's cool. You know, I never, after that era, it seems like the whole Riot Girl thing took on a stigma that, at least to me, that I really didn't pay attention to a lot of what was going on. But that was, they were a ferocious band in their own right. And I liked early Bikini Kill stuff quite a bit. I think that would have been really cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, like that's the only thing about this that where you have to qualify it a little bit is, when I first heard this news, all I'm hearing in my head is like the title track to like Reject All American, and then that's not the kind of song that they played. Like they for Tammy Ray is a pretty,
yeah, or like Rebel, yeah, Girl or something. You think, you know, like if you're gonna play one song, you want to hear Rebel, yeah, Girl, right?
they played what is essentially a ballad, so they didn't go insane with this or anything, which is what my brain just immediately jumped to. But hey, you know, I always like hearing about bands like that are like beloved and not doing anything but could, and it's almost better that they aren't, because it just gives them this, I don't know, like this sense of mystique about it that eventually when they do something, it's a big deal. It's the Fugazi issue, right? Like they're
Next year, I'm predicting the headline.
Like there's Fugazi
reunion.
No,
Bikini Kill.
if Fugazi reunited, it'd be in like some bookshop in Washington D.C. or something.
Or it would be like they reunited and played to no one, and then eventually word of that trickled out, and then they all denied it.
Like on the roof, like that last Beatles concert. It was just like no, friends. And
I like, know. Adam White's perspective. Like they did a show in like Ian MacKaye's basement just for that. Like, so like it was the purest show ever, you know.
Just like under a single light bulb, like a single bare light bulb on
the
door.
For the right reason.
The weird thing is, like, I don't like as much as I love Fugazi. That, well, like they could probably do it because that they would be stubborn enough about it. But like, whenever one of these bands gets back together, it's not like the getting back together just blows the mystique away, right? So you know, the Misfit, like. Glenn and Jerry's Ice Cream, they're back together, they're playing shows, and like that's really cool, but like it's not
I might disagree, Adam, because when
but the same thing with like the Jawbreaker thing, like Jawbreaker got together, played shows, like, oh, okay, like cool, like, but like as like the that news drops, like my excitement level on that news, like if you were to graph it, like rapidly craters where all of a sudden it's the excitement of like oh my god, it's actually happening, this band that no one thought would ever get back together or is back together, and this is a band, like, you know, the members aren't dead, they, you know, they could physically be back together, right? So you know, no zombie situation. It's not like the Clash with Rome, right? Like we're seriously back together. And then, but just like immediately afterwards, I'm just like, well, I get what they're going to do. They're going to go out and they're going to play the hits and people are going to pay a lot of money for it. And I'll try to clamor to get into a show that I'm not going to try to get into.
They might be able to go up to $12. That's it.
Yeah. So, out. So, so before, like as cool as I think the Misfits thing is, there is no part of me that has been moved to try to figure out if I can go.
I mean, the Misfits thing is
like,
a cash grab.
And I think it's a cash grab they're entitled to, but it's not. It's not excited me to the point where like I need to go like hop on a plane to L.A. and go try to get into that show, right?
No, nobody's. Yeah, you know, if you want to give them $100, you can. Nobody's putting a gun to your head. It's capitalism. You know?
I might disagree to a degree, Adam, in that like when Amoebix reunited, it was mind blowing. Like it was so amazing to see them live, and it didn't feel like a cash grab. It felt like Amoebix because I mean, let's be real.
There was no cash being grabbed. Yeah, very little.
Like when Amoebix came back and were as amazing as you thought they would be and did new stuff. Like the mystique wasn't shattered. The mystique was strengthened that like you actually hear this band live doing what they do live, and what the record suggested, they're even better and heavier and deeper than that.
Well, but that's probably the exception rather than the rule.
Well, true.
I'm sure you would acknowledge that.
All right. So what's our last story of this part? The last story of this first half.
Here's a guy with no mystique whatsoever left at all.
Yeah. John, this is a you story here. Let it rip.
All right. Ozzy Osbourne. Get ready, boys. He's going on his final tour. Don't get too shooken up, though, because it's going to last 2 or 3 or maybe even more years. Also, it's not really his final tour. Ozzy is starting his, quote, final tour in 2018, and he says it will likely run through 2020, 2 or 3 years. The lineup will be Zakk Wylde returning to the Ozzy Osbourne fold, as well as Rob Blasco Nicholson and Tommy Clufetos, and Adam Wakeman, who is son of Rick Wakeman. Tommy Clufetos has been with Ozzy for a long time, I believe. Ozzy stated in the press release, "People keep asking me when I'm retiring. This will be my final world tour, but I can't say I won't do some shows here and there." So it's really a not that bold of a proclamation. It's Ozzy saying he's not going to tour as much as he had, even though he hasn't toured at all in the past couple of years, except with Sabbath, I guess. But he might do shows afterwards. The point being is this the most cynical kind of farewell tour, and that Ozzy's saying, yeah, it's my final tour. It's going to last 10 years. Be sure to give me all your money. Or is it the completely non-cynical final tour and Ozzy not saying, this is it, this is the end, but rather I'm slowing down, so it's going to be less and less in the future. So is it totally cynical or totally non-cynical?
I don't know how you can call it final.
Go ahead, Adam. I'm gonna close this one out.
You close this one out. This stretches the valid use of final. Not because I expect that he's going to change his mind on this and do stuff anyways, but to do anything that is a multi-year endeavor as an old man. Everyone pretty much gets that you could kick it at any moment. And I don't think that you need to, I don't think it needs to be billed as, holy shit, this is your last time to see Ozzy. Just let him, just do your thing. Like, we all know that. it's apparent. You could go at any minute. I don't know. Like, it just seems like unnecessary marketing that too easily becomes a punchline. And there's so much about Ozzy Osbourne that can easily become a punchline that I don't know why you guys to throw more wood in that fire. Just tour. We all know it might be final and it might not.
Or don't. Or don't.
Okay, Tom, go.
Well, no, it's just funny because you talk about, so you start talking about Ozzy Osbourne farewell tours. Earlier, we were talking about how I have like a metal box full of tickets still. And as soon as we start talking about that, and I remember the Ozzy thing, I thought I better go run and grab my ticket stubs here because I went to Ozzy's farewell tour previously. So what I have here is Tuesday, February 11th, 1992, 8 p.m., Wings Stadium, Kalamazoo. This was Ozzy's farewell tour. $18.50 for the ticket, general admission, pretty reasonable, and free parking. Actually, what'll really blow your mind is the fee on an $18.50 ticket from Ticketmaster in 1992, $2.25.
Now it's $9.
That would be at least, that would be at least 10, yeah, probably 10 bucks now. But anyway, yes, I saw Ozzy on his final tour, and then I dig a little deeper into my stubs. I see Ozfest 1998. Didn't pay for that. Ozfest 1999. Ozzy Osbourne here in Grand Rapids. This was, what year was this? I don't know. Ah, December 7th, 2010. And that was $65 for that ticket, which I didn't pay for either. But anyway, so yeah, you have to forgive me for being a little cynical. And the thing is, honestly, Ozzy solo stuff sucks. I have never been an Ozzy solo fan. The reason I went and saw him in 1992 was because I was a big Sabbath fan and he was going to retire. And then I actually saw Sabbath, the real Sabbath, all four guys, not like this lame ass final tour they just did. I saw them twice, once at Ozfest and then once at the arena here. So anyway, yeah, I mean, listen, go see him or don't go see him. I don't care. He his solo music is not that good, and he's an old man. He's probably
How come no one ever mentions that the first two solo albums, which are considered his best by far, are like cheesy as hell. You know what I mean?
They are. I mean, yeah, you know, you hear a song on the radio, you might not throw up, but yeah, I think you and I talked about this too, John. You know, there's some bands that as a band, they're so good. And then when the front man goes out, like I love the Police, but Sting's solo albums are
horrible. Oh yeah.
And Ozzy, I kind of falls in that same camp with me. It was the magic of it was all the pieces worked together to make something magic. It wasn't just the singer. So anyway, yeah, if you listen to, you know, Paranoid or, you know, War Pigs or something like that, and then you listen to freaking
Crazy Train.
I mean, it's just right. It's just cheesy, but yeah, you know, Mr. Crowley comes on, I won't turn it off. But you know, anyway, go see this or don't. I wouldn't.
I would for like $15.
What about $18.50 with a $2.25 fee? I probably would do that too, if it was convenient. But it's more like $100. You know, $13 to park. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, we're just gonna let it all fade out like that.
That was a sag. Yeah.
All right. Well, I we need to play a song and then come back. John, what do you want to do?
You want me to play a song? Okay. Yeah, tell you what. We'll talk about this next band real quick. But the Drew Getz is one of my favorite newer bands. They just put out a split 7-inch. But they're also doing an album now. The Drew Getz, and I'm a little bit interested in Adam White and Tom Trauma's take, is there are four young ladies that dress like the Droogs from Clockwork Orange. They're basically an oi band, but I would say they're kind of a punk band because they're not strictly oi, which I like, mind you. So I'm going to play them covering an Accused track. And this is off their split with Vice Squad, and I think it's really neat. I mean, they play electric music, but this is them doing an acoustic cover of an Accused track. So it almost sounds kind of like Peter, Paul, and Mary covering an oi band, which I think is very interesting and clever. And so this is the Drew Getz covering the Accused.
We'll be right back. glass that you create. The hooligan down on your street. The folks you pray you'll never meet, it's true. Violence in your town, the riot that you can't put down, the hooligans that you call scum, the ones who never ever run from you. We're the hooligans,
hooligans.
We're the ones who always stay dead. The hooligans,
hooligans.
We're the ones that you created.
We're back. We got a few more stories that we'll talk about this week. I don't know what they are because I keep losing my notes here. But here, hey, look, I found them. It's amazing. So we're going to talk about a couple pieces of media that came out. So the first of which, there is a new song by the long-running punk band GBH. They've released a song called Blue Sky Thinking. The track is going to be on their upcoming record, Momentum, which is coming out on the 17th of November on Hellcat, the Tim Armstrong-led, Rancid-related Epitaph Records subsidiary. So you can find that song over on Punk News or on YouTube to go check it out. Any thoughts on a new GBH song, Mr. Tom?
Yeah, I thought it was all right. It's pretty cool. I'm actually kind of looking forward to hearing this. I mean, it wasn't the greatest song ever, but it was pretty good, pretty cool. Pretty crisp sounding.
Yeah, that,
at least for my phone, like in the living room while people were watching TV.
That's the best way to listen to music, really. That's how
I'm beginning to cram sessions are where it's at.
That's how the audio files
pre-podcast, you know, cram sessions. Yes.
What you just said there is the kind of thing that would give like Neil Young a heart attack. Like he's trying to sell everyone his fucking
like super audio,
things. Yeah. And you're like, oh, I listened to this song on my phone while people were watching TV.
And that, you know, and that's not how I listen to music. I do not, I'm not a phone listening guy, but I just like, oh, they want to talk about this song, I better listen to it. And I held my phone up to my ear while the family glared at me watching some like tiny house hunter show or something. It was cool.
John, what do you think? GBH.
You don't like tiny houses, John?
I can't stand those house hunting shows. I've got an interesting take on this slightly, but related to the next story. So why don't we hit the next story and I'll tell you my combo attack.
Ooh, okay. So the next story here is Frank Turner, the English singer-songwriter. He has released a video for a song called There She Is. The track is coming from an upcoming compilation that he's putting out called Songbook that's coming out on November 24th. Now, Songbook is it compiles songs from his catalog, and then it has a bunch of reimagined versions of songs that people kind of already know and love, and a new track. That new track is this the new track? Yes. The new track is There She Is. So this is like the one completely new piece of music that is going to be on the Songbook album. Would you call that an album? Is it a compilation? I don't know what it is. The Songbook thing. This is the new song that's on it. So John, I'm just going to there. I've set it up. What's going on?
Well, first of all, woof. I mean, woof. I,
So you loved it.
This is bad. I mean, I don't mean that it's bad, that it's a bad song. It's like,
it's pretty mellow.
No, not that it's mellow, just that it's stupid. I mean, it's like, this is the kind of music that you would literally hear in a Hallmark commercial. Like, you know, it's like, you see like a guy, like, he's like, oh man, I want to get married to this girl, but I don't know how to tell her I feel about her. I know, I'll buy this Hallmark card. And then they show the guy giving the Hallmark card to the girl, and like, this song is playing in the background. Like, this is beyond adult contemporary. This is like TV commercial schmaltz. And I'm saying, How did this get in a punk webpage? How did this get? Because Frank Turner used to be considered a punk guy, Millions of Dead, is that the band? And he also has
Millions Dead.
He also has that band called the Marauders or something, or the Kublai Khan or whatever that band was called, or something like that. The Khanate. I don't know. He's got some other hardcore band.
I don't know. He's got
I'm enjoying listening to you massacre the names of Frank Turner's band.
Anyways, but I'm like, oh my God, it makes me question the state of contemporary punk, that this would be even accepted. I'm an open-minded guy, you know. I'm usually the guy bringing a whacked out punk that people hate, but I'm like, if punk represents anything, it's the antithesis of this. It's like, he's like, she's my everything and I'll never leave her. And it literally could be on, you know, adult contemporary. It literally could be on a Hallmark commercial. It's garbage. I'm sorry. This is everything that punk is against. I'm sorry, Frank Turner. I know that you want to write a song about how much you love your wife or whatever, but this ain't the place for it, baby. And anyway, it's ham-fisted to begin with. Like example, Nick Cave might write the same kind of song, but he would do it without it being like, having sound clips that you could put in a Hallmark commercial, whatever. Like, there's no finesse to it. It's just him like hitting all the cliches in adult contemporary radio. It's like, it makes me question everything. Like, how is this even here? The point being is the following. We've got two long-running punkers, GBH, Frank Turner. GBH is longer running than Frank, but Frank's been around about 25 years. That's long-running. And it's two ways that one can take their career. GBH has just been doing the GBH thing year after year after year, three-chord punk, which is commendable. I would say I'd prefer that my bands that I like branch out a little bit, but at least they're doing what they're doing. By contrast, you got Frank Turner, the guy that's so punk that he's not scared to not do punk stuff, which I guess. But there is a point. It's like there's an analogy is like, we all know this guy. He's a guy that was really into hardcore, like NYHE hardcore. But now the only thing he listens to is like mainstream hip hop. And somehow by only listening to mainstream hip hop, he tries to create a certain veneer that he's more dedicated to punk than you, because all he listens to is mainstream hip hop. And then that somehow suggests that he really understands what punk should be and what it has failed to do, when really he's just a guy that likes mainstream hip hop and is kind of embarrassed at what he used to be. That's what we've got here. Frank Turner is making wimpy music and he's embarrassed at what he used to be, but he's scared to admit it. So the point being is one more path more noble than the other? Doing the same thing over and over and over for 40 years, or straying away? I'll say, against my intuition, doing the same thing for 40 years over and over and over is more noble than what Frank Turner is doing, just because at least it's kind of good. This is garbage. I'm sorry, Frank Turner, but I don't mind you straying away. But if you stray into what the opposite of what everything we've built for is meant to be, then I don't think there's any nobility in it whatsoever. I think it's crap. I'm sorry, Frank. I'm sorry. I think you're a nice guy. I've read interviews with you, but this is bad. I mean, like Sting could put this out, and that's saying a lot in 2017. I'm sorry.
Ooh. This is not something I like, and I'm generally much more sympathetic than you towards the career path of the guy that fronted a punk band doing a acoustic or singer-songwriter thing. And I'm way more okay with that than you are generally. I don't need people to always be hard or loud or even aggressive, so long as what they're doing is compelling. And I guess that's what's missing on something like this to me, is it's very schmaltzy. It is the most straight up it's a love song, but like to use that as a negative implies that you can't do that in a way that's compelling, and that's a disingenuous thing to say. But it's so dramatically soft and dramatically normal and dramatically just worlds away from whatever influences that he would have had from being someone that was into aggressive and underground music. So none of that shows through on this. Even when Frank's been doing, you know, straight up kind of crowd pleasing acoustic rock stuff, there was always that string that you could use to connect that from there to him being in a punk band or him being in a garage rock band or something like that, right? Like those connections were there. This is so mellow and so polished and so contemporary that you would never be able to make that connection if you didn't already have the context of who the artist is. And you can't judge a piece of music on what the artist has done in the past, because that's not necessarily fair to anyone. So yeah, this is not, I don't know exactly who this appeals to. And I am doing something that I never do, because I like my own sanity. But right now I'm looking through YouTube comments on this, on the thing about this song, to see what people are saying about it. Because the one thing that we lose as people on this continent, John, is in England, Frank Turner is huge. Like, enormous. Like, he is a major, major recording artist in the UK, and like polar opposite of the kind of draw that he is here. I saw Frank the last time I saw him live was a couple years ago, and he opened a show for a Canadian folk singer songwriter guy named Joel Plaskett, and like Plaskett, as far as like Canadian indie rock goes, is a pretty big name. But Frank, I don't even think was billed as being the opener. He just was the opener. Like, he just walked out and he's like, "Hi, I'm Frank Turner." And he's just like a skinny guy in a dirty t-shirt. And he played a bunch of songs. And then he went back to England like that week and sold out stadiums. And
I'm so sorry you had to sit through that, Adam. I'm so sorry.
No, it was cool. I liked it. It was fine.
If you need somebody to talk to, you can talk to me, Adam. I'm always here for you.
I'm genuinely okay with the things that Frank Turner does with his career. But I mean, not this song, but in general, I have been. But with that context on it, like with the context of it, of him being like a person that can sell out stadiums in the UK, I wonder if there's some calculation, however cynical, that he made on his end, where he's like, "All right, you know what? If I write this sappy, super mainstream, super toothless love song, yeah, the people that record dumb punk podcasts in North America aren't going to be cool with it, but I'm going to be able to buy like a fucking hovercraft in England." Because you're talking about like that Hallmark commercial. Well, it's specifically going to be like Hallmark commercials in England, where this is going to be the thing. Like this, I wonder if this is just like one of those swings for the fences, where if you're an artist, you kind of hit like a certain level and you say, like, you know what, I could keep doing what I'm doing, or I can, you know, take the risk of doing something that's maybe not that artistically compelling and live as a rich person for the rest of my life. It's like that same calculation that, you know, all these bands that like pop punk bands post Blink-182 that signed to like fucking MCA Records or something like that would have done, like fucking H2O. So they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we were a New York hardcore band, but we'll record a dumb pop punk album. Are you going to give us $60,000? And MCA is like, yeah, sure, here. And they're like, all right, let's do it. Maybe we'll have a hit. And oh, it didn't work out. Shit. But Frank Turner, like, he's a big name over there. Like, he's got enough momentum behind him in that market to take something like this and make it into some sort of money tree. Now, that does not say that I have to like it, and I don't, but I wonder if that's the calculation that's going on here.
I bristle at the swing for the fences analogy. It's more like try to lay down a fair bunt and beat it to first base, I'd say. But yeah, it's.
I mean, you know? Jump at that. At the
I
fame.
I know what you're saying. But yeah, I mean, it's. Listen, he did that album, the Tape Deck Heart, a couple of years ago. I mean, wasn't that an attempt to make mainstream pop music?
You know what? This is one of these things where, like, are you a British person and you listen to this show? How big is Frank Turner over there? And how would something like this play? Because I think that my impression.
Well, he plays like Wembley, right? And here he's playing like.
Yeah.
I know when he plays Grand Rapids, he plays for less than 1,000 people.
Yeah. Like I get the impression that the Frank Turner that we understand here is a different, like is a different fictional character than the Frank Turner that they understand over there. And I think that this is the kind of thing that plays into that. And they get, you know, he can probably put on his North America hat and look at this record and go, that's not really going to play well at Fest. But then he takes off his North America hat and puts on his like big fuzzy Palace Guard hat.
Beef Eater hat?
Yeah. And he goes. Right? Like
Adam wins the podcast.
So that's how I understand things work. So I know we have a number of listeners that are British people or English people, or I don't want to offend anyone. I don't know what you call you people. You people.
I believe it's Ukensians.
Limeys. I think it's Limeys.
I believe it's Ukensians.
Ukensians, yes. but the ones of them that I know of all listen to older punk rock, so maybe they don't have a lot of time of day to give to Frank Turner in the first place. So I don't know. This is a bewildering song, and I'm not sure what to make of it, and I've given Frank a lot of passes for other stuff, but I can't really do it on this one. So yeah, I don't know. That's a bummer. Tom, you bring us out of this.
Shall I play a song?
Do something.
Do a little dance. So today was election day in the United States for our, you know, those of you in Canada or the United Kingdom or wherever, and you don't know that, off your election, very bad turnout. Usually I know in our little town here, we had like 12% turnout, and we're usually pretty good about these things. But anyway, so I'm going to stick with the, semi-political theme, and I'm going to play a song by a Canadian band, called the Riptides, pop punk band, been around for a long time, put out an album earlier this year called Canadian Graffiti that is really good. And they have a new 7-inch coming out with one of the songs from that album and a real exclusive B-side, which is not available digitally, but I'm going to play the A-side, and it's about kind of the misadventures of Wimpy Rutherford, who is the original queer singer, and the song is called Wimpy Goes to Washington.
Wimpy! We drove down to New Hampshire to record with tyranny. Arrived at the electric game with Tito's steak and cheese. We called up our friend Wimpy to lay a vocal down. But useless, just told us he skipped town. Why? Because Wimpy goes to Washington. Wimpy goes to Washington. Yeah, Wimpy goes to Washington.
I suppose we should mention that that Riptides record was recorded in part with the assistance of Greg Simpson, the Punk News Podcast producer who we know and love and I'm sure smells wonderful. And
he's the one who actually turned me on to it because it's sort of they're one of those bands that sort of existed in my dead spot as far as not really following much new stuff. So yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah. So there you go. Hi, Greg. I hope you're doing well. So anyways, that should be it for the Punk News Podcast. If anyone wants to email us again, podcast@punknews.org. If you're a British person, please explain what's going on to Frank Turner because we don't understand. and anything else, John, you want to leave him with?
I'm still breathless from Frank. It's going to take me a while to recover from Frank Turner's track. Let me tell you. Woo, Frank, baby.
The wonders never cease. All right. See you guys next week.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@velourundergroundstudios.com.